Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's another Wildlife Wednesday. And here to answer your questions about the animals of Wisconsin are Jamie Nack and David Drake. I tried to combine your last two names. Oh, my gosh. David's an extension wildlife specialist and professor at UW-Madison. David, welcome.
Happy New Year, Larry.
Happy New Year to you, and as well to Jamie Nack, who is an extension senior wildlife outreach specialist. Good to see you as well, Jamie.
So nice to be back, Larry.
We will be talking about all kinds of things as we normally do, and of course we want to hear from you. Maybe you've seen some fox or coyote around your town, or maybe you've enjoyed participating in Project Feeder Watch. There are lots of things we can talk about, and I hope you'll join in with your questions and maybe your experiences as well with wildlife. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You know, I have some wood carvings in my living room, and a couple of them, one's a barn owl, and the other's a snowy owl, and I've got some really wonderful piece of art on the wall that is of some barred owls. And so I've got a lot of, I see owls every day. Yeah. You know, I kind of find to talk about owls, yeah. David. And we have, how many species do we have?
We have 11 species in the state. There's 19 across North America. And owls are one of those birds. I'm not sure that everybody could identify each of the 11 owl species in the state of Wisconsin. But owls, as a group, are one of those birds that just about everybody knows about or can know something about, can identify at least if they see a great horned owl. They probably could say, at least say it's an owl, as opposed to, you know, like a red poll or a white-winged crossbill or some of these smaller birds that are a little bit more obscure to people. And we've got roughly 400 bird species in the state of Wisconsin. So we've got, you know, 11 owls are part of that mix. And, just fascinating animals. You know, I think most people from cartoon characters to the owl that sold Tootsie Roll lollipops to other things like that, other character references. Everybody knows generally what they sound like. It's a hoot, hoot, hoot generally. And that mostly they're nocturnal. Mostly they eat small mammals, have very good night vision, can turn their head not all the way around 360 degrees, but have pretty good neck mobility, which is pretty amazing.
Pretty far around.
Yeah, pretty far around. They are silent flyers based on how their the feathers on their wings are kind of tattered at the end, trailing end of their wing. So a lot of times they might even fly over your head and you might not even know it because they're so silent. But a lot of times you'll hear them, you know, for the most part. We talked about 11 species of owls. We really have 7 that kind of occupy our state. 4 of those species we consider up in Canada or Canadian species. That would be the great gray owl, hawk owl, boreal owl, and then the snowy owl, which we do get snowy owls into Wisconsin. We've had them sighted again this year in Wisconsin this winter, not as much as when we have a full eruption of them, but they're here. And for the most part, again, you know, most of the species are nocturnal, but the snowy owl and the short-eared owl, you are more likely to see those during the day, which is pretty cool. And the snowy owl in particular is kind of an open land animal, so a lot of times it's not uncommon to see them on the tops of silos at barns, at farms,
sure.
or on telephone poles or something like that. And just a, you know, beautiful white bird. But they're fascinating animals and really very integral to the ecosystem. You know, they do a lot of wonderful things in terms of controlling pest populations and things of that nature. Super cool animals.
Rick in Monona has a question relating to owls. So let's go there. Rick, hi.
Hello, everybody. I'm enjoying your conversation about owls. We have them in our backyard, great horned. We hear them at night. We've had screech owls in our backyard. Mm-hmm. They're just wonderful to have in your yard. And I can't tell you the number of times I've gone out barefoot in my backyard and tried to see them up in those pine trees. Yeah. They're almost impossible. The crows, of course, tell you where they are, too.
Yep.
So that's always fun. But my question was about where are they in their nesting cycle right now? It seems to me they have they lay their eggs in, what, December or January, and their young hatch in February or March?
Yeah. Generally speaking, yeah.
Yeah, you're a little early. So generally, the great horned owls are one of the earliest nesting species in the state of Wisconsin in terms of bird species. And so they'll start pairing up in the fall. That's why we hear them so often, because they're calling for mates. They're patrolling their territories, things like that. But they won't actually start laying eggs until sometime in February. And then it's a little roughly about a month of incubation. So you'll start seeing owlets, mid-March, late March, something like that.
Yeah, so it starts when? It starts
So they're paired up now. They'll mm-hmm. start nesting now, roughly this month, and then they'll start laying eggs maybe mid-February, something like that.
And what are the nests? What's the
It depends a little bit on the species. The great horned owl is our largest owl, and that particular owl doesn't use cavities or artificial nest boxes per se. They often will build their nest or utilize a stick nest from another species. Or if you think about a snag, so a standing dead tree where it's been topped off and you just have that exposed top, they may have a nest right in the top of that snag. So other species that are year-round residents, the saw-whet, the barred owl and the screech owl, they will utilize a cavity for nesting, and you can also supplement cavities by building nest boxes too.
Yeah.
So
we've got a great horned owl call, and I think everybody probably knows that call, but let's listen anyway. I think Brad's got one up here. Yeah.
So a couple tricks if you do hear that and you're going out and trying to locate that owl, there's a general guideline that the larger the owl, the higher up in the tree you'll find mm-hmm. it. So great horned owls tend to be higher in the tree, and then they'll be perched near the main branch rather than out on a limb. Again, really concealing their identities or their location. So, and then if you happen to have night vision, that's fantastic. But otherwise, binoculars with lower magnification that have a greater field of view can be helpful, or simply going owling on a very moon, full moon mm-hmm. or nearly full moon night can have its advantages too.
And one of the things that's really fun to do is if you can locate where the owls are roosting during the day or are around, that you can go under those trees and look for owl pellets. So, mm-hmm. They're not able to digest the bones and the fur of the animals that they're consuming. So they will compact that into a pellet and then kind of regurgitate that and just drop it under the ground. And so it's a really fun thing. A lot of elementary school students are dissecting owl pellets and finding all these small bones in there and trying to reconstruct what the owls are eating. But yeah, they are really neat animals. And one thing, as the caller mentioned, is a great way to find owls and hawks is to, when you've got crows that are congregating or a murder of crows, which is a group of crows, if you hear them or see them, they typically will point out where these owls and hawks are, because they are, as a group of crows, they are protecting themselves and they're identifying a potential predator to themselves and others. And so if you hear a bunch of crows just making a racket, look up where the crows are and see if you can't find a hawk or an owl.
Yeah.
And the same is kind of true with chickadees. If you hear mm-hmm. a mob of chickadees or a lot of chickadee activity, they may be pestering a saw-whet or a screech owl, one of the smaller, probably around robin or bluebird, blue jay size owls that we have.
Scott and DePere emailed us a photo of a screech owl that was napping in one of his woodduck boxes.
Yeah.
Oh, we've got that up.
Yep.
That's pretty cool. In terms of owls. I'm thinking the barred owls because barred owls are pretty cool owl, and I like their sound too. But talk a little about barred owls.
Yeah, so the barred owl is the second largest owl that's a year-round resident, and as such, super common, even in urban, suburban areas as well. And they're the one that has the notorious "Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all?" in terms of what its hooting sounds like.
Why don't you hoot that for us?
Oh, we got actually Brad's got that right, up. Let's listen.
Sounds just like you, Jamie.
Yeah, right. But the barred owl is just striking, and it gets its name for the vertical barring on its chest. So they will take up residence in cavities, or it is a species that you can build an artificial nest box for. Now's the time of the year to be doing that. If you want to build a new nest box, or if you already have owl boxes out, now's the time to clean them out and then prep them for the next year. And I think it's about 3 to 5 inches of shavings that you want to get in there at the bottom of those nest boxes.
I'm wondering about ethics here. Is it okay to try and get an owl to answer you?
Yeah, so there's a generally accepted code of birding ethics that hopefully all birders are aware of and follow. But when it comes to owling or looking for owls, a couple of the things, especially during breeding season or when they're going through courtship, you don't want to be playing electronic sounds of owls because they end up spending their time stressed about that potential competitor rather than focused on feeding or protecting their territory. So we really minimize or eliminate the use of electronic owl calls. And then also keeping your distance. So especially I think about it a lot with snowy owls. They're, you know, when you find them, that usually draws in a crowd of people.
Yeah.
And somebody always wants to get a little bit closer to get that, you know, perfect picture. And reality is there's so many people that are professional photographers that have excellent equipment that don't need to get that close to, you know, to capture those images, that we can rely on those images rather than trying to get our own picture. So if you notice that the owl is fidgeting, it flies off and lands again, like, you don't want to keep pursuing it. Just back off. That's a good sign that you're too close. And of course, if you're wondering if you're too close, you're probably too close.
Yeah, probably. David Drake and Jamie Neck, our guests today. We've been talking a lot about owls, but of course we'll take other questions as well, and you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. We'll get to Jeff in Merrill in just a second, but I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to WPR News. Taking a look at the world of wildlife in our state today, Larry Mueller here with David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist, and Professor Jamie Neck, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both affiliated with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and Extension as well. You can join in with your own stories or questions or comments about wildlife. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe you've got a photo. We got a great photo earlier about screech owl, and you might have a good wildlife picture as well, and you can send that in along with a question to talk@wpr.org/Larry, and or just talk@wpr.org, I think is all you need to do, and we'll get it. Jeff and Merrill, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, Happy New Year, everybody, first of all.
To you as well.
I go to work very early in the morning. I'm on the road by 4:30, and one morning on my way to work this last fall, I saw a little clump of feathers on the side of the road, and I knew it was a barred owl. It was standing straight up with its little head tilted down, and he was not in good shape. I think he just got hit by a car before me. Owls that, you know, dive bomb for a mouse, they often run into windshields, unfortunately. But he was just standing there with his head down, and I pulled over, I have a blanket in the back of my SUV, and I put the blanket over the owl, and I could tell it was in bad shape. One eye was closed. Put it in the car, went to work. We have a place in Antigo in our area here mm-hmm. called the Raptor Education Group.
Yeah.
Fantastic human beings over there. And we also have ambulance services, many volunteers that, you know, are able to pick up an injured animal and get it over to Marge and her crew in Antigo. So I got to work. I called somebody to ambulance the bird to Antigo. They took the bird in, and he was there for about 6 weeks. He was a young bird. He was malnourished. He had a hematoma from where he was hit. But those people at the Raptor Education Group got him back to health, and I was so happy when I got a call, and they said he's ready to be released. So we picked him up, and we brought him back to where I found him, and we let him out of the box, and that was one of the best moments seeing that bird fly.
What a cool story.
Yeah, that was just, you're going to remember that forever, yep. And I really appreciate you sharing that because it's really good information for the listeners, too. So yep. If you do come across injured wildlife that need your assistance, the Department of Natural Resources has a 1-800 number that you can call and they can direct you. But also there's a campaign that involves both the DNR, Extension, and wildlife rehabilitators called Keep Wildlife Wild. And within that website, again, hosted on the DNR's page, you can get a list of wildlife rehabbers to call.
And yeah. Marge Gibson does
fantastic.
She's absolutely fantastic.
Job. We've interviewed her many times. Jeff, thanks for that story, and appreciate it very much. And appreciate your work there as well, and saving that owl. That was great. I want to go back. There was something that you wanted to talk about a little bit, David, relating to rabbits and owls.
About owls, I'll just make this last comment about owls. But Jamie and I get quite a few emails over the course of a year from homeowners and others who say, I found a headless and fill in the blank in my yard. So headless rabbit or a headless squirrel or whatever the case might be. And oftentimes when an animal is decapitated, that is the work of an owl. And oftentimes it's the great horned or the barred owl. And typically what they'll do is they'll catch the animal and then they will decapitate the animal. And then they eat the brain out of the brain case because that's one of the most nutritious parts of the animal for the owl. And then they leave the body there. So for anybody who's ever wondering what the heck is going on and why are we finding animals with no heads, most often it's an owl that is causing that issue.
Mm. Marie, I'm sorry, emailed us. She often hears barred owls in her neighborhood, and she loves hearing them call, but she's wondered, who are they talking to? Other owls? If their calls alert prey animals that owls are around? And years ago, she saw a reference to owl ventriloquism? Well, ventriloquy in ornithology textbook footnote.
Yeah.
Ventriloquy. I can't remember the title and don't know what the source was. Did she hallucinate or was that a real thing?
Well, I don't know that you hallucinated, but I'm going to look it up when we're done.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that.
Well, so the question is, who are they talking to? They're talking to their own species.
Right.
And they're either trying to attract a female if it's breeding season, and or they're advertising that, you know, somebody lives in here and this is a territory that's defended. And if you're another barred owl, for example, stay out of here. Otherwise, there's going to be trouble. And I'm wondering if the ventriloquy, if it's not, there are birds that will mimic other mm-hmm. birds. And I'm wondering if that's maybe what she was talking about.
Yeah, could well be. Tanya, in Stevens Point, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a little funny story about an owl. It was right outside my window. I woke up one morning and heard him out there. And so I got my phone camera out and was trying to get pictures. And I really wanted to get close up, so I grabbed my binoculars and tried to flap my phone with the binoculars. And eventually I got it focused in and was looking at the owl. And, you know, it was morning, and he must have been tired of hunting. He's looking around a little bit. And he kind of settles in, and he sits there for a minute, and he starts nodding his head. and I'll, like, he's falling asleep, you know, and he starts nodding and nodding, and he jerks up like he just darn near fell out of the tree. And he kind of shook it off a little bit, and he scooted closer to the trunk and then settled in and fell asleep.
Leaned under the trunk.
Yeah, leaned under the trunk. But it's just like a person when you see him nodding at a party, you know.
He was up way past. He was up way past his bedtime. He was tired.
We always expect the animals to be graceful,
right?
And then when we see them do these awkward things, for one thing, it's just so unusual because we don't see it very often. But it can be pretty dang funny when they're not acting as graceful as we expect them to.
And I was recalling the comments earlier about crows and owls. One thing, reason why crows don't like owls is my understanding. Correct me here if I'm wrong. That they roost at night and they really can't move. I mean, they're tied to whatever they're holding on to.
Yeah.
And it makes for easy pickings.
Yeah, they're unsettled by it. Yeah, they want to draw them out of there.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah, the owl can, and they tend to be together.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you get, especially in urban areas, you can get crow roosts of, you know, hundreds of crows that.
But you're not going to find owls too far away from them either.
Right.
Then.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. So they'll predate crows.
Very easily, because essentially they're locked into whatever they're holding on to. My understanding.
You mean the owl's locked into?
Or
the crow.
The crow.
Yeah, so perching birds, they have this really cool mechanism that when their leg is straight, that the tendon that runs along the backside of their leg is relaxed. And so then they've got the ability to flex and open their toes. Mm-hmm. But when they're perched and that leg is bent, it increases the tension on that tendon that runs the back of their leg, and so it locks their feet onto whatever surface they're perching onto. So it's like a vice grip, and so that's what allows them to sleep and not fall off the perching substance or substrate.
Wayne emailed. That's interesting. That's one I don't think we've ever mentioned on the show before.
That's what we're here for,
cool.
Larry.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Wayne emailed us. He's thinking about predator birds like hawks, maybe eagles. Why do you always see little birds like blackbirds chasing them through the sky? And why do the eagles put up with them? Sort of answer this, but
yeah, we've kind of talked about it a little bit, especially from a predation or I think about like little birds that are chasing crows. You know, crows are going to be a nest robber, going after nestlings and eggs and things like that. So, again, these birds have their territory where they're raising young, and they're trying to drive any potential threat away. And in terms of why eagles, you know, put up, I mean, it's kind of comical to watch, you know, an eagle or a hawk fly and have these little birds come after them and dive bomb them and peck on them. They don't seem all that concerned, but they also don't have the aerial maneuvering capacity to probably do a whole lot about it either.
Yeah.
They're not as quick.
Kay in Sauk Prairie has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Kay.
Hi there. I forgot the name of the owl, but it's the one where they had to cut back logging out on the West Coast to protect
the owl. The northern spotted owl.
Okay. So now I heard that they're going to eliminate tens of thousands of barred owls in that territory to assist the spotted owl.
Yeah. Because
the barred owls just outproduce and outhunt. And what I'd like to know is how can you selectively remove one species of owl?
Yeah. So this is an interesting story, and it is tied tightly back here to the department that Jamie and I are part of. So we have a colleague, Dr. Zach Peary, who has studied northern spotted owls his entire career, and they've done some just fascinating work on protecting the northern spotted owl, which is a rare species out west. So one of the things that they've looked at or determined is that the barred owl is a non-native species. It has actually invaded the northern spotted owl's range. And it is out competing the northern spotted owl. And so what they are doing, and it's not just Dr. Peary and his group, but the U.S. Forest Service and others are behind this and supporting this, but they are selectively removing barred owls from the territory where they've invaded the northern spotted owl territory. And they do this essentially by hunting singularly barred owls. So they are out with shotguns walking across this mountainous territory and forested territory. And when they see a barred owl, and they do, I'm assuming, I don't know this for a fact, I'm assuming they call them in to try to be efficient with some of the hunting. But essentially they're hunting barred owls to remove them from this area where the northern spotted owl is. And one of the things that they found, they just published a paper, and I can't remember the exact number, but barred owls, they found through a diet study that, and Jamie, if you remember this, help me, but they found that I think barred owls had impacted negatively upwards of 29 different species, and some of those 29 species were also rare and protected species. And so, and it's not across the entire range of barred owls, but it's in that area where barred owls are invading the northern spotted owl territory. So it is a controversial management effort. Not everybody is supportive of removing barred owls, killing barred owls, but it is being done to save a vulnerable species, which is the northern spotted owl.
And that type of management takes place across the country on different species
does,
as well,
yeah.
But owls are particularly yeah. charismatic, and it becomes yeah. even more sensitive.
Yeah, and so. The northern spotted owl has got a really kind of a contested history or I guess with humans, because they were being impacted by some of the logging that was going on, especially on the public forest of the Pacific Northwest.
Restricted,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, there's a conflict that's been set up between this endangered species and humans trying to make a living protecting forested ecosystems. And so this is a long-standing issue with northern spotted owls especially in the western part of the United States.
Yeah. Kay, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Fall Creek emailed us a great photo of a saw-whet owl.
Yeah.
He was very close to that. He's 3 to 5 feet away from him when he took that photo. So I
yeah.
don't know.
Yeah. So in that one, compared to the small screech owl, you see, I know listeners can't see, but there's no visible tufts. Mm-hmm. They do have ears, but you can't. It's a rounded head.
Yeah.
And then also a very distinct white V.
On their chest. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking
between
the eyes there.
Between
the
eyes, yep.
I think Brad might have a saw-whet. Yeah, we've got a saw-whet owl song. Let's listen. Sounds like me trying to whistle.
So many, many years ago when I was attending a research course when I was a student, we stayed in a dorm at a field station, and outside, very wet lowland area, lots of conifers, but just outside the dorm, there was this toot, 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 toot all night long. Like, what is that? So I have this very imprinted memory of what the saw-whet owl sounds like. So.
Oh, man. Well, it's a cool... I mean, it does sound like somebody trying to whistle.
Yeah, and, you know, we talked about this earlier. 11 species, you know, 7 or so that are findable in a normal year, 4 that are pretty common residents. It doesn't take too much listening to some of the songs and calls to be able to learn your owl sounds and then be able to go for walks at night and figure out what species you have in your neighborhood.
Yep, and that's the best way to do it is by song, because you'll hear them much more commonly than you see them.
Yep.
And we have, I'm pretty sure Brad's got a song of the snowy owl, which is not the coolest song in the world, but we've been talking about it, so I thought, well, let's listen to what a snowy sounds like.
Just a little bit of a growl. What is really, what I pick up right away is you hear all the other birds that are active. So for most of the owls, you're going to hear them before you see them. Mm-hmm. But the exceptions are the snowy owl and the short-eared owl that are more diurnal or crepuscular, active during dawn and dusk, and you're more likely to see them. So the snowy you're going to find, and whether that is at an open grassland area, airports, along coastlines, harbors, places like that. You might find them sitting on a hay bale or sitting right on an ice heave. Yeah.
There was a number of years ago when they were doing work on the Memorial Union here at the UW-Madison campus, there was a crane, a construction crane, and there was a snowy owl that was sitting on top of that construction crane. It was, you know, standing out there like a flag. It was really cool to see it.
Diana emailed us along a different line here a bit. She's a rural mail carrier.
Look at that. Yeah.
In Upper Michigan. By the way, we have a lot of rural mail carriers who listen.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
I get emails from rural mail carriers
awesome.
All the time. excuse me. She's in Upper Michigan. One day there was a young hawk stuck in long grass in the ditch. She picked it up and put it in on the side of the road. She kind of scared it a little bit to get it to fly away and went up in a tree and just watched her drive away. The hawk was, she felt stuck in the grass somehow.
Huh. Might have been stunned.
Yeah, stunned or.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that could well be.
Yeah. Or a lot of times, you know, as was alluded to by a previous caller, you know, owls get hit on the roads because not only are they dive bombing for something a meal that's crossing the road, like a small mammal. But they also, when they're eating or feeding, they are obsessed or focused on that, and they don't always necessarily notice that there's a vehicle coming toward them.
Abby in Polk County emailed us the photos.
Oh,
she's been watching the variety of woodpeckers at her feeders this year, five in all. She gets the pileated or pileated, the red-headed, the red-breasted, the downy, and the hairy. She learned the red-headed is rare in her area in Polk County.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, the redheads are more of a migratory species than those other species that you mentioned. But, yeah, really neat.
Pileateds, well, what's their range? I was trying to, you know, you don't see them. I don't see them, at least
down
in
here.
Southern Wisconsin, but they're certainly.
We spend quite a bit of time on a property in Columbia County, and we have them there. I know my parents have them over in Sheboygan County, so I think they probably are statewide. Mm-hmm. We probably just have more of our older, mature trees in the central and northern parts of the state.
Yeah, where they would. I've never seen one in Madison. I don't know why they'd want to be here.
Yeah.
They don't really have a place to.
Yeah.
And talk about a call or a song.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah.
Recognizable. Yeah. So all these songs that we keep referring to, I'll just throw a resource out for everybody. But the Cornell Lab of Ornithology has a number of excellent websites as part of their web page. But there's one called All About Birds. And if you just go into it and you search the name of any bird, and it'll have life history information, range maps, information about their breeding and how many eggs and their incubation periods, and then also some songs and calls. So that's often where we point people when they're trying to identify a song.
And another, we've already talked about this briefly, but the other app is Merlin, which is also associated through the Lab of Ornithology at Cornell University. And a Merlin, it's an app that you can download to your phone or your tablet or wherever you want, but they also have the ability to, you can hold your phone up and it will identify, generally, most of the time it's accurate, it will identify the bird that's calling that song, which is pretty neat. So it's essentially an avian version of Shazam, if you're trying to understand who sang that song.
Right.
I was thinking back, just before we go back to the phones and Carl in Eagle River, thinking about being in Peninsula State Park, which is a favorite park, and a pair of pileateds had three young.
Oh, nice.
And they, so you, we were, I mean, the young were on the ground, all over the place, but it was really fun to observe a pair of adults with three young pileateds.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah, and that's, of course, would be that's a really good spot for pileateds. Carl in Eagle River, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I've got a great story about a screech owl. I was driving near Lake Pepin at about 2 a.m. with my cat and wife, and all of a sudden we heard a thump on the side of the door in the middle of the dark, and I pulled over, and here lying in the middle of the road was a dead screech owl. so I carefully picked it up and put it underneath my car seat so that my cat wouldn't get at it. And all at once, my cat went absolutely nuts, and here's an owl flying one way in the car, and flying the other way in the car. And so I grabbed the owl and held it tight until we finally managed to get home and put it in my bathroom and closed the door. And here, when I opened up my hands here, I realized that the owl must have been shocked and was completely dead. And I was showing my wife how sharp the talons were, and all at once it opens its eyes and grabs a hold of my hand with its talons.
Yep.
And we had it for 3 days in our bathroom to make sure it was all right, and then we let it go, and it flew away perfect.
Huh. Are you still married?
Yeah, she loved it.
That's an amazing story.
It is a wonderful story. And one thing we should probably mention, and we've talked about the barred owl, I think, that was rescued by the person in the screech owl now, is there are laws in Wisconsin as to how long you can hang on to an animal. And so this is not an implication of anybody, because everybody's got the best of intentions and only wants the best for the animal, for sure. But just so you're aware, that you are allowed, without the required necessary permits, if you do not have the appropriate permits, you are allowed to hang on to an animal for up to 24 hours. And within that 24-hour period, you are required then to find a licensed wildlife rehabilitator if that animal needs assistance. And Jamie talked already about Keeping Wildlife Wild and that initiative that the DNR and others have. But just be aware that there are laws out there to protect, and it's to protect animals. But just make sure that if you do rescue an animal, please do find somebody within 24 hours that's licensed and can take care of that animal appropriately.
Peggy had emailed about wondering if it's a good idea to touch wildlife with your bare hands. It might be a myth, but she's heard that the oils from our skin will damage wildlife or will leave a scent that will repel other animals.
Yeah, so Peggy, really, really good point. I think it depends a little bit on the species that we're talking about. So when we're talking about amphibians, so they have a semi-permeable skin, and if we're handling them and we have lotions or insect repellent on our hands, that can be harmful to them. So, we don't want to dissuade children from, interacting with a frog or, being curious and all of that, but certainly washing their hands prior to that or getting them wet first can help that frog, and not holding it for a prolonged period of time where you're stressing that animal out. So there's that balance of, we want kids to be curious and have these interactions, but not for too long. In our family, it was like 24 hours and we're not naming anybody. So, they could collect toads and frogs around the house, but they were released, before nightfall. So I think that's kind of important to find that balance. And then the other is, I think, a bit more of a myth as it comes to birds. So it's always been taught, you can't touch an egg or a nestling from a robin nest, or you name the species of songbird, or mom won't come back. I think as parents, we've probably said that to our children to get them not to do it. But in fact, most birds have a pretty poor sense of smell, and their instinct to come and take care of their young is far stronger, and they will return and come back.
Go on, Larry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and 100% Jamie's right. However, there are mammalian predators who have very, very good sense of smell, and they will pick up your scent that might be left on that bird or the nestling or the egg or whatever the case might be.
And having done work on grassland birds and looking for and marking and returning to their nest, there's also you need to be careful about leaving scent trails that predators may follow. Finding a fawn or something like that in the woods, too, you don't want to hover or spend a lot of time there. Just go ahead and back out. And
I was flashing on the naming part because,
yes.
and I was recalling Michael Perry, who's a great author, once on the show, I think he mentioned they had two pigs he was raising on his farm. And some people visited, and they said, "Do you have names for the pigs?" And the little girl said, That one's bacon and that one's ham. Oh, man. Talking to David Drake and Jamie Dack about all things wildlife. And I hope you'll join in. We've heard some wonderful experiences and stories, and you can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife today with our two experts, David Drake and Jamie Nack. David, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Nack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both affiliated with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Great to have them along. Questions for them, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk at WPR.org. We were talking about pileated woodpeckers earlier, and I said I'd never seen one in Madison, but then, of course, we got an email from Michael who says, hey, pileated woodpeckers can be found at the UW Arboretum.
And which would be a good place to find them with all the trees there.
Yeah, that'd be a great place to find them for sure, and I hadn't thought of that. But I don't think I've ever seen one there, but that doesn't mean they're not there. And if Michael's seen them, they're there. Diane emailed us, when dealing with owls, her friend and retired DNR wildlife educator Chris Cold mentions the business end of the bird. Owl talon can be dangerous.
Yeah, their amount of grep or pressure per square inch can certainly do some damage, which is often why I think anybody that is a capable handler is using a leather glove, right? Yeah. But yes, Chris is a well-known wildlife educator with the Department of Natural Resources and does lots of birds of prey programs, and at times has had his own birds, educational birds.
Elizabeth in Green Bay emailed us. Her dogs bark constantly at the squirrels and birds when they travel along the the wires above their house. If she puts up a decoy owl near the wires, would this keep the squirrels and birds away from the wires?
Maybe for a short period of time, but our experience with an owl decoy is considered an effigy, is the group of deterrents that we refer to. Owl decoys, scarecrows, fake coyote, things like that. Eventually, animals get wise that the owl never moves or doesn't oppose any threat, and they continue on. So taking a multifaceted approach would be better. So eliminating any ways that they're getting access to the wires if you can. So if there's something you can wrap the telephone poles with, of course, you probably need to get permission to do that. That can be helpful. And just putting more pressure on them than just the owl decoy.
Yeah, you might find a small bird sitting on the head of the owl.
Right,
yes,
right.
Exactly.
Sue in Stone Lake emailed us. After feeding birds in winter for several years, she's finally has this beautiful red-headed woodpeckers at her feeders. And that's in addition to the hairy, downy, red-bellied, and pileated. Are these birds rare? Are their numbers increasing? She may be referring to the redheaded, which was the first bird she mentioned, but we could talk about any of them, I guess.
Yeah, so they're all common species of woodpeckers. The redheaded woodpecker, that population declined some, but I believe it is back on the upswing because of some of the habitat. One of the places, I've always thought of redheaded woodpeckers as being more in a savanna-type landscape where you've got open grasslands with dots of trees here and there.
Farmlands, pastures.
Yeah, that type of thing. Yep, exactly.
Tree snags that are still...
Yep, for sure. And when they were declining and then they started coming back, a lot of times people would see them at golf courses, which was kind of a replica of oak savanna-type landscapes. But my mom lives up in central Minnesota, where there are a lot of trees, and they've got red-headed woodpeckers where there's not a lot of open land. So I'm not sure if we've misclassified the habitat relationship with redhead woodpeckers, or that they become more adaptable and are actually starting to use more wooded landscapes than we traditionally have thought that they used.
Somebody else is wondering, will owls use nest boxes made by people? And we did see a photo of that earlier.
Yeah, and this is a great point, or a great time to maybe mention another resource for listeners. But yes, the year-round residents that we have most commonly for owls, the great horned, the northern saw-whet, the barred, and the eastern screech, three of those four will use nest boxes. And the one that doesn't is that great horned owl. It's the largest of our owls. So the other three, you can build or purchase and put up a nest box. What we always stress is right bird, right house, which is kind of a slogan.
Right location.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That, again, Cornell Lab of Ornithology, they have a webpage called Nest Watch. And among that page, there are descriptions and directions and installation information for nest boxes of a variety of species. What's important is that barred owl nest box has the specific sized opening so that the barred owl fits, right? Whether they have need shavings or they need, for example, wood ducks, you need to have a mesh ladder, or you need to gouge the side of the wood so that nestlings can climb out. Otherwise, they'll hatch the nestlings and they'll be trapped in the box. So there's important features on every nest box that are geared towards that specific species of bird. So doing a little research can be very helpful. And then again, going to nestwatch.org, I think it's .org, or .com. Nope,
.org.
You should be able to print out those directions and get more information on how to build them.
Another great resource was from a retired biologist at the Minnesota DNR, Carol Henderson. And I think he put out a 70-some page guide to all sorts of different boxes and houses that are used by birds and a multitude of species.
And that one is called Woodworking for Wildlife.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great.
Yeah.
I was thinking about bluebirds.
Yes.
I'm a bluebird fan, and we've talked about bluebird houses, and somebody said, I had an expert on the show once, and he's, you got to be careful how you make those bluebird houses, depending on the hole size. If it's the wrong size, they become great owl feeders.
Yep, and they can get in there. Yeah. Same is true with wood duck openings and easy access for raccoons and things like that too.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
And then placement. So wood duck boxes, it'd be better to put them on a pole rather than a tree, things like that. Yep. So lots of tips that have been researched that going to these websites can save you a lot of heartache. Hopefully increase your odds of success.
Yes, and be beneficial for the species you're trying to help.
Yep.
I saw a wood duck house kind of in the middle of it was sort of a watery swamp, and it was stuck right in the middle. I don't know how they even got it up.
Probably during ice, or when it's frozen.
Or a rowboat, yeah.
Yep.
Or a rowboat. And I wondered if, I didn't see, there wasn't any woods right around it, so I thought that was a little unusual in a way.
I worked on a birding project in between my master's and PhD down in the coastal plain of South Carolina. We lived in a house that had this big pond behind it, and it was rung with wood duck boxes around this pond. But there were also three resident alligators in that pond, and I just envisioned every time there was a hatch that those alligators were just with their open mouth as the wood duck nestlings, fledged. It's like popcorn just falling into the alligator mouth.
Well, on That's that sad. Popcorn note, we'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us, and then Dave and Jamie will be back for another half hour. Join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, or a photo. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here looking at the world of wildlife today with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack, both with affiliated with Extension and, of course, the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Join in. The number's 800-642-1234. You could email to talk at WPR.org. And Kelly in Oshkosh has something for us. So let's go right there. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I grew up camping in Washer County, Ottumwa area, from the late 60s through 70s, and I always loved hearing the whippoorwills at night. Mm. And I seem to have a bit of a decline in them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is true. I think, from what I recall, and David, correct me if I'm wrong, their decline has a lot to do with changes in habitat, mm-hmm. Forest structure. I think some of the habitat requirements or where they thrived in the past were actually grazed woodlands, mm-hmm. and we don't do a lot of that grazing for other environmental reasons. But it's that open understory that they favor, which is now replaced with invasive species in many of the southern areas of the state. I still do hear them in a few places, and when I hear them, it's usually during spring turkey hunting when you're out, and that's always a highlight for me to hear the whippoorwills and know that they're still there. But yeah, I think their numbers have. We could dive into it a little bit more by digging out the breeding bird survey data, which would be available online too, and look at their changes over time.
They have declined, and it's kind of sad. Going back to my days as a kid and listening, I was raised on a farm.
Yep.
And those whippoorwills.
Yep. I bet you bobwhite quail are similar for you too.
Yeah. The same way. Yep. Kelly, there you go. Thank you for calling. Craig in Somerset. We'll give you a chance. Hi, Craig.
So I've got a weird experience I need to tell you about it, and I need to know if it's not the right thing to do. So when I moved to Somerset, I was out ice fishing, came back, slipped my sucker minnow out in the backyard. Cat drug it out. Next thing you know, a barred owl swooped down and grabbed the sucker minnow. I said, oh, that was kind of cool. So I flipped out another one. Barred owl swooped down and grabbed it. This happened on occasion. And then I got out one day and I kind of dangled it with my fingers. He came, swooped it, grabbed it, flew off. That happened a few times. And then the barred owl just kind of never showed up anymore. But I was kind of curious, is that a bad thing to do? I mean, you don't want to get abused to humans and everything, but I thought it was just a cool experience.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely a unique experience, mm-hmm. and it demonstrates the varied diet that some of the owl species have, too. So, typically when we talk about feeding wildlife, we do encourage people, really stress not feeding wildlife and some of the harmful things that can relate, whether it's poor nutrition. So if you think about people who often feed bread to farm or park ducks, that's a nutritionally poor diet for them. So that's part of it. The other you alluded to a little bit with habituating animals to coming into contact with humans. So in an urban setting, let's just use red fox for example. If somebody's out feeding fox or raccoons, eventually they're can become an issue, and we're concerned about disease risks or animals protecting themselves and biting and those sorts of human health and safety situations. Same is true for black bears and bird feeders and things like that. So in general, feeding wildlife is generally not a good idea. We do recognize feeding birds. We talk about feeding birds, winter bird feeding a lot on this show, and that is certainly something that people enjoy doing and brings them close to nature. And if done properly, is not frowned upon. So I think David and I both feed birds. I know Larry does. So certainly that's more accepted. I would just say the caveat, if you choose to feed birds, there are still precautions and steps that you need to be taking to keep those birds safe. So whether that's placement of your feeders so they're not colliding with windows, making them less susceptible to predators in terms of your placement, cleaning up the seed if it's moldy, watching and monitoring the health of the birds visiting your feeders that they're not spreading a disease at the feeders themselves. So there's a bunch of ethics and responsibility that come around if you choose to feed birds. In addition, in 60 of our 72 counties, there's a ban on baiting and feeding deer. So that means when you feed birds, those feeders have to be elevated and out of reach of deer as well. And that, of course, is out of concern of chronic wasting disease. So typically, feeding birds, feeding squirrels is fine. Beyond that, we really try to discourage the public from doing that.
Yeah. There you go, Craig. Thank you so much for calling. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234. Give a call or shoot an email to talk@wpr.org. I wanted to turn our attention to elk a little bit because We've got the data on the elk hunt and so forth this year, but the reintroduction of elk has been, I would consider it a success.
Yeah, I think everybody would consider it a success. So, yeah, the story of the elk, elk are one of the larger hoof species we have in the state of Wisconsin, along with deer and moose. Moose is not very common in Wisconsin, but is here occasionally. And elk are native species, were extirpated due to overhunting and habitat loss. So for a long time, they were not in the state. And then around 1995, I think it was, the DNR wanted to reintroduce elk back into Wisconsin. So they traded Kentucky some rough grouse for elk.
Oh, that was turkeys.
Turkeys.
So the elk,
right,
though, was a partnership, financial partnership.
That's
back
right. In. Yeah, that's right. It was turkeys. That's right. So they brought, I think, 25 elk in to the Clam Lake area up in the northwestern part of the state. And then there was a subsequent elk reintroduction, oh, I don't know, what's 8 years ago, 10, something like
somewhere
that, in
the Black River Falls
area. Yep. And so they just concluded a hunt. Once the elk got over about 400 individuals, they were able to have a hunt, and so they just concluded a hunt. 13 people were randomly selected from over 26,000 applicants. The hunt occurred, I think, from October 18th to December 19th. There were 8 bull elk that could be harvested in the Clam Lake area. 4 of those bull elk permits were sent to the Ojibwe tribe as part of the treaty agreement. And then there were 5 antlerless elk, and there were 4 bull elk in the Black River Falls area. And I think 7 of the 8 bull elk were harvested, and all 5 of the antlerless elk were harvested. And the tribal hunt just concluded last Sunday and was longer. It went from roughly Labor Day to just after New Year's Day. And I'm not sure what the success was on the tribal grounds. Yeah. But
I don't think that's in yet. I think they still have opportunities. So.
Yeah, they just ended last Sunday. The tribal hunt just ended last Sunday. So, but yeah, it's a success story. Obviously, the earlier elk, the native elk, were from the eastern species. The reintroduced elk were from the Rocky Mountain elk species or subspecies. And so I think, what, there's 3 or 4 elk species in the North America.
There might even be more than that.
More than that, something like that. But yeah, regardless, it's been a very successful reintroduction. And then obviously, if you're harvesting, that's probably the ultimate suggestion that you've successfully restored the population because you are able to sustainably harvest a few individuals out of that population.
You know, what'd you say? 36,000.
26,000 over 26,000 applicants. Yeah,
and. And each applicant has to spend $10 to apply, and then $7 of the $10 goes back to elk management program here in Wisconsin. So it's several hundred thousand dollars,
which involves, you know, a lot of habitat work, creating and maintaining openings for elk. I was going to mention that now is a reasonable time for elk viewing opportunities as well. So both the Clam Lake herd and then the Jackson or the Black River herd especially in the Clam Lake area, they have a kiosk that they keep updated with information on suggestions on places where you might find those elk. And there's some similar ethics in terms of elk viewing from a distance and not providing or using electronic bugling sounds and so on. So typically September's the prime time to go and see the elk, but this time of the year they're more congregated around wildlife openings and you might have a better chance of seeing them. So local restaurants and establishments, the local biologist in the area can often give you some tips on where you might find them if you're going through those areas at all.
And a lot of people wonder why, especially if you don't hunt, why do you spend so much effort on restoring a population just to hunt that population? But as you've mentioned, you know, it does restore economics, and a lot of that funding goes back into the management for the elk species in particular. And elk in particular, because it's a growing population, they are also starting to be engaged in some damage issues. So they're starting to damage some agricultural crops and things like that. And elk are one of the few species that are eligible for the Wisconsin Damage Abatement and Claims Program that's run through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So if the species is harvested because some money from the hunting license goes into that damage abatement claims program, if the species is harvested, like elk is now starting to get harvested, then there is some cost share assistance to help farmers with management activities to reduce or eliminate elk damage, and they can also get monetarily compensated. So there are a lot of benefits and upsides from harvesting these species as well.
Bob in Claybanks has a question relating to the elk herd, so let's go there. Bob, hello.
Hi, Larry and guests. Thanks for taking some time today. Two questions. Is there any suspicion of CWD coming from the elk herd, and are they being tested for that?
So there has been, I was on the elk management page a couple days ago, and there's been no documented cases of CWD in wild elk in the state. I don't know this for certain, but I would be shocked if they were not testing. I'm pretty sure when these harvested animals, that biologists are actually there on these elk harvests and collecting biological samples and data that happens with every harvested bull, or in this case, there's been 5 cow elk harvested this year.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely a great source of additional data and information.
And prior to them, when they were brought into the state and prior to them being released either into the Clam Lake area or the Black River Falls area, they were quarantined as well and were regularly tested to make sure they had a clean bill of health before they were released.
And I did want to just correct something. The first elk, we actually had elk a long time ago from Yellowstone that were in the state. Then the first reintroduction in 94-95 came from Michigan, those first 25.
Oh,
and then
that's
we started supplementing with an agreement with Kentucky in 2012.
Yep.
So got a couple different genetic populations
Which
going
on.
Which
is probably a good thing.
It is.
It
a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Very good
yep.
thing. Bob, thank you very much for calling. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. And obviously, there's if something appears, I know that DNR is going to be talking about it.
Yep,
for sure.
Matthew
in Iron River, Michigan. Your turn. Hi, Matthew.
Hi. I normally each fall I'll harvest a deer or sometimes two. I process them myself so I have leftover fat. And I'll usually just kind of gradually scatter that around to help the birds and squirrels and stuff. But now the subject come up about feeding wildlife. Am I really helping them or is that... Should I maybe stop doing that?
So, Matt, I do the same thing with the fall harvest of deer. You've got a lot of fat on that along the back vertebrae, and we'll take out those chunks. I just make sure that I elevate them in. Usually I'll look for an evergreen tree, a spruce or something like that, and lay it across the branches. Or you could hang on to that and put it into your suet feeders. And then those suet feeders themselves are elevated. So I would just put it out there for the songbirds, but in a manner that it's not accessible, not so much that deer would be interested in it. But I personally don't want raccoons and possum and skunk and all those animals coming into the yard and feeding off the ground. So I just elevate. But, yeah, that's a very nice high fat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good thing for the birds and could be for the skunks and the raccoons as well if you have it that way. Mark in Duluth sent a photo. Oh, wait a minute. I've got a different photo up here. Oh. Let's see. The photo that we're looking at is Eastern Screech Owl. She says, Judy and Wauwatosa, in their front yard, first in a hole in a maple tree, the next 3 years in an owl house with a Ring camera in it.
Oh,
that's
gosh.
Cool. And I'll tell you, if that, I know the listeners can't see this, but there's a pair of screech owls. And if the one was not sitting on the outside of the tree, it would be hard to see the one that's poking its head through the cavity because it blends in so well with the bark.
Yeah, it's a great, great picture. I don't know if we have a song of the Eastern Screech Owl. Maybe if we do, Brad will find it and we'll give it a listen. Jerry in Appleton called. She's got an owl eating the side of her house. She says if it keeps up, she's not going to have anywhere to live. Her house has cedar siding. Any ideas as how to get the owl to quit that? I'm surprised it would be an owl.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's a woodpecker.
Yeah, there's something else going on there that would be very unnatural behavior for an owl. I can't think of any, because they're capturing live prey that's scurrying around the yard.
She's got a woodpecker.
The only possibility is that there are mice that are on the inside of that, on the inside of the outside boards, or that they're running up the wall somehow, and the owls are actually after the mice in the walls.
Yep, or a flying squirrel
or something like that.
What I would suggest is if you have access to a trail camera or a Ring doorbell, you know, anything like that, that you can set up a little camera or video on it, that would be really helpful to figure out what's actually going on there.
Yeah, and you can look either on the internet or maybe ask around, but you can also maybe have a pest control company come out and take a look either, or a nuisance wildlife control operator. But again, you know, just like you would check references for a plumber or an electrician, you know, make sure you find somebody who's reputable and is insured and that you trust.
And back to screech owls, I think Brad's got a screech owl sound for us.
Yep. That's neat.
Yeah, very, very, very neat. And it, I think people sometimes wonder if it's not somebody crying or making
And they describe that as a whinny or a trill.
It's a cool it's a cool song, nevertheless. You know, we've got the Great Backyard Bird Count taking place for 3 days. That's starting in February. And that's a global event.
It's 3 days from February 14th to February 17th this year. So it's a great Valentine's Day date. And it's anywhere in the world. So you can count for as little as 15 minutes, or you can count for as long as you want to. But again, between February 14th and February 17th. And even though it's called the Great Backyard Bird Count, you don't have to do it in your backyard. You can do it any place you see birds and any place you are. And then there's an online form where you can upload your sightings. And they had a couple years ago, I think 300,000 people at one time counting birds, and it was the single largest community science count anywhere in the world. And so it's extremely helpful. The Audubon Society for the United States, the equivalent of that in Canada, and the Lab of Ornithology at Cornell University kind of all coordinate to run this. But if you have the opportunity to do it, it is an awesome exercise. You can do it with your kids. You can do it by yourself. You can do it with your, you know, spouse, partner, whatever you want to do. And again, you can do it anywhere in the world, but do it during that 3 day period.
You know, it's, you know, your cabin fever is kind of set in at about by that time. And Jamie, I think you've got some suggestions for those who might have some cabin fever and want to get outside and busy during these months.
You know, there's already birds in the next couple of weeks that are going to be singing on spring territories, like chickadees and cardinals. So but we still actually have a couple of months probably of snow and some cold. But I would encourage you to take a look on the Department of Natural Resources events pages. It is amazing, all of the different activities, events they have, often located at state parks or natural areas. But not just the DNR's website, Travel Wisconsin, the Department of Tourism's main website, and other nature centers in your area. But I've seen things from candlelight hikes, snowshoe hikes, winter bird hikes, which often includes owling and an evening night hike. Let's go ice fishing, winter how to winter camp or go winter camping, scavenger hunts in the winter, and also indoor projects like crafts or nature journaling and other educational programming. Now with a new fresh snow, I think we're supposed to get some snow maybe on Thursday, but great time to go and look for animal tracks. I was just working with our youngest daughter, teaching her the difference between a squirrel track versus a rabbit track and bounders and hoppers. And so lots of fun things to do there as well to get kids outside bundled up and active.
I've had a lot of friends who said, why would anybody want to go ice fishing? And I always say, well, it's a lot of fun. And that DNR ice fishing, it actually happens on a free license weekend. Mm-hmm. Oh. You don't need a license.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they give you all the information you need. And really, you only have to, make sure you got a good pair of boots and some decent clothing, mm-hmm. and they'll take you out. And I can't even remember the lake, but you can look it up, and you'll get great advice on how to do it, and just see how it's done and why people do it. I love ice fishing. Yeah.
And as a Wisconsinite, you're obligated to do that at least once, because, boy, talking to family and friends in southern parts of the states, it's... they think we're crazy. Yeah. They just cannot fathom that you go fishing on hard water.
Yep.
And coming up, we're going to be talking about bald eagle watching days in Prairie du Sac. And you've got an idea of how to watch bald eagles this winter as we wind up the show, the Bald Eagle Nest Watch.
Yeah, so this is a program that was started in about 2018 with formerly the Madison Audubon Society, now called the Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance. It's a community science program that you can get involved with, and it essentially is helping the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources gather information about eagle nests, primarily in the central and southern part of Wisconsin. It is replacing what the DNR used to do for aerial surveys. So instead of doing a pre and post aerial survey during the nesting time to look at numbers of nests and successful nests, now you can essentially adopt a nest as an individual, and they ask that you go out once a week and take information about that nest and determine its success and fate of that particular nest. So they are still looking for volunteers in a number of different areas. I'd encourage you to go to their website. There are some areas of the state that they have full coverage of the current nest, but all volunteers receive training that teaches them everything they need to know about the program, and through the program then they can monitor the distribution and the success of eagle nests in the state.
And what the heck, an hour a week?
And there are active eagle nests in every county of the state, so no matter where you live, there's an eagle nest near you.
Yeah, check it out.
And speaking of eagles, we're going to talk about eagles next. Thanks so much to David Drake and Jamie Knack, David Extension Wildlife Specialist, Professor Jamie Knack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both, of course, connected with Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology here at UW-Madison. And coming up, some great opportunities to see eagles, and we'll talk about eagle watching days next with Jeb Barzin and Jennifer Lanzendorf. That next. I'm Larry Mehler. You know, each winter, bald eagles gather in the Sauk Prairie area to hunt and perch and roost. And one weekend a year, the community gathers to watch them and celebrate bald eagles. And you're invited. Larry Mehler here talking about bald eagle watching days with our two guests, Jeb Barzin, president of the Fairy Bluff Eagle Council and directs their eagle research. Jeb, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
And Jennifer Lenzendorf with us again, once again. She's a board member of Fairy Bluff Eagle Council, serves as chair of the Sauk Prairie Bald Eagle Watching Days organizing committee. And Jennifer, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
As we talk with our guests, I hope you'll join in. What do you wonder about eagles? Maybe there's one roosting near your house. Let us know your favorite places maybe to watch them soar. And if you have a question about the watching days, I certainly join in. Number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email the talk at WPR.org. Jebby, eagles are doing pretty well in Wisconsin.
Eagles are a wildlife success story.
Yeah.
They've really recovered well from, we think that there is maybe 108 nesting pairs in Wisconsin in 1972, and now there's, I can't remember the number now. I think it's well over 1,500. We don't really have a good estimate of the total number of nests, but they're doing rather well. There are some disconcerting things that are in the news also, though, such as eaglets with PFAS contamination that was in the news just this morning, including the lower Wisconsin.
Yeah, and maybe we'll get to that as we go along a little more about that. That Great Lakes Eagle Health Project is certainly doing some good work, along with others, obviously, as well. And the abundance of eagles in Sauk Prairie area, Jennifer, I mean, they got a good place to go, I guess.
It's been a great season so far, and we're really excited to have a great turnout of eagles for our Eagle Days, which is coming up on January 17th, Saturday. And we're going to have some great presentations and hope to have a really good number of eagles in the area. And yeah, we're excited. It's our 40th anniversary this year for Eagle Days in Sauk Prairie.
Yeah, it's really cool. And January 17th, in particular for me, is a lot of fun because you've got bus tours.
Yep.
And some great programs, the Live Birds of Prey by the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center, which is fantastic.
Yep, we're going to have two shows by Schlitz Audubon, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. And yeah, we're bringing back the bus tours. We haven't had bus tours in a few years, and we're going to have four bus tours throughout the day on that Saturday. We will have volunteers at the Overlook on Water Street to help people see eagles. We'll have those all day Saturday and Sunday. So just lots of opportunities for folks to actually get out and see the eagles.
See the eagles. And I got to put in a plug for David Stokes. David, and I've seen his presentation. He titles it Laughing with Animals. But if you have kids or grandkids, and you want to see the eagles, but you should also go to the River Arts Center. And well, you'll see both the Live Birds of Prey you can see. And David Stokes is just an amazing presenter. And especially when he's got the kids sitting around on his blanket and talking about and showing all of the wildlife. The kids are going to learn a bunch, and you'll probably learn a little bit, too, as you watch.
David is a very pluggable person. You're absolutely right.
Oh, man. I just think he does such a great job. I've watched him, and he's superb in it. And if you've... And, you know, if it's a nasty day, or even if it isn't... get down to Sauk Prairie and see the eagles and then go and watch him. He's on from 11:30 to 12:30 on Saturday, I think.
Yep, he's a fantastic presenter for like you said, great for the kids. We've also got kids' activities at the Ruth Culver Library, which is right next to the Overlook there. So we definitely have some opportunities for folks to get inside and out of the cold a little bit if they want to, and lots of activities for children. To get the kids engaged and get that next generation of eagle lovers.
Yeah, you can watch a presentation, and there's bus tours right after it. Watch a presentation, get on the bus, take the tour, go that way, and you're going to have a wonderful day. I've done it many a time, and I've really always enjoyed it. And I think especially if you've got kids, they're gonna love the experience. Sean in Wausau has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to you for decades, and I just wanted to let you know I'm going to miss hearing your voice over the noontime hour when you retire.
Oh, thank you, Sean. Thank you very much.
No problem. For your guests, I have got a place a little west of Minocqua up north, and I've had a nesting pair of eagles two houses down. They've been there for 10, 12 years now, and we love watching them. Especially in the spring when they hatch their new chicks. You can hear them screaming in the morning for food, and we watch them kick them out of the nest, and they kind of stumble, fall down, try to learn to fly, try to get their wings. It's been great watching them for, like I say, 10, 12 years now. I guess my question is, how long is this nest going to be there? Like, what's the longevity of an eagle nest? The thing is huge now. It seems like they add on to it every year, and it's just the top of a very large white pine. They've just kind of taken it over. And the whole lake loves it. Everybody watches them and, you know, kayaks over and checks them out. But I'm just wondering, how long is it going to be that we're going to see this? Do they have a lifespan, or do they just keep building them and fixing them and stay till the wind knocks them down or something?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, Jeff, that's the answer.
And I don't mean to be too flippant, but you've actually... Your observations are spot on. They add to the nest every year. The nest will continue to be used unless one of two things happens. The tree and or the nest falls down. And, you know, when those nests get big, they can be well over a ton.
Yeah.
And so that can cause the tree, if it's a dead tree especially, to fall over. But sometimes the wind can blow or knock a nest out of the tree as well. So those kinds of things will cause the birds to start over. But the other thing that can influence the birds is sometimes if nest parasites build up, they'll go to another nest within their territory and build that up, and then they might switch from one nest to another, but it's all still within the same territory. And so that's another reason why they might leave. But I think the thing that's most fascinating is what you can learn by watching these birds over a long period of time.
Absolutely. Here's a little aside, as I was thinking about David Stokes. David Stokes showed a large photo of from Minnesota DNR, I think it was. Anyway, it was a bear apparently hibernating in an eagle nest.
It's pretty amazing.
Sean, you probably don't have to worry about a bear coming in. Maybe Wausau, yeah, I guess you could have a bear hibernating in the eagle nest, but probably not likely. Anyway, thank you so much for calling. And Bob and Kiwani will go to you. Hi, Bob.
Good afternoon. I just want to put a plug in for anybody that was thinking about joining the Bald Eagle Nest Watch. I'm going on my third season this year. I myself have four nests that I'm watching in the Kewaunee County area, and it is an incredibly fulfilling, it's just a wonderful thing to watch these things that when they hatch, they're about the size of a not a whole heck of a lot bigger than your fist. They're basically a beak with a little bit of feathers on them, and within 4 months or so, they're full grown. They're out, and it's just amazing. They are, you get a sense of ownership, sort of. You feel akin to them. You feel very responsible, and it's just wonderful.
Oh, Bob, thank you so much. The Bald Eagle Nest Watch, and he's in Door County, I believe, but.
Kewaunee County, but I'm a member of the Door County Bald Eagle Nest Watch. It's run out of the Ridges Sanctuary.
Ah, okay. Well, a comment, maybe Jeb?
Well, I think, it is a great program to be involved in because you're learning and you're providing data, much needed data, for us to be able to monitor eagle populations, and that's just a wonderful activity. For Fairy Bluff Eagle Council, we are comparable activity is we count birds in the wintertime. And so we watch them as they fly into their night roosts. And that is a way to try to monitor the populations that, of the birds that winter in the lower Wisconsin River. And I think that's an equally fulfilling sorts of activities. In fact, we did our roost count last Sunday, and pretty much for 2 hours, I watched 9 to 15 eagles all at one time doing courtship flights over their roost, and watched them lock talons and free fall, and watched them do tandem flying and all kinds of courtship behaviors and calling to each other. And most of these were immature birds. So they're not even, this isn't about nesting. This is about kind of learning about each other. And so there's all kinds of wonderful things that you can see if you get out there into our wonderful outdoors. And then if you volunteer, you know, you learn even more. And yeah, whether it be Nest Watch program or winter roost counts or other activities that you can partake in, it's just wonderful.
Yeah. Jennifer, how'd you get involved and develop your interest?
I've been a birder for many, many years, and I actually got involved with the Fairy Bluff Eagle Council through the roost counts. I started doing that with someone else in my community who got me into doing that, and now I have a roost that I coordinate and count every year. I'm also involved in that the Nest Watch program. So yeah, great love of eagles and being involved. It is incredibly rewarding to be able to, as Jeb said, get outside and really connect with nature in that way and get to observe the eagles doing what they do in the, you know, in the winter and through the nesting season, and getting to see the young grow up is also very rewarding. I call them sock puppets when you just see that little head with those feathers. But yeah, love doing the roost count and, getting to see that courtship behavior and, the eagles interact as they all fly into the roost in the evening it's very rewarding, and it feels like it's an opportunity to sort of give back to citizen science and the community and these organizations that I value so much.
Jenny Lindenzorf and Jeb Barzin, our guests today. They are both with the Fairy Bluff Eagle Council. We're talking about Bald Eagle Watching Days coming up January 17th. And 18th. On the 17th, there's a whole string of programs starting at 9 in the morning. Well, the lobby opens then, I believe. And then there's tours, bus tours. You're going to have a chance to see eagles. There's a couple of great shows, Live Birds of Prey from Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. And David Stokes, as we were talking about earlier, with an unforgettable presentation that he does. He titles it Laughing with Animals. And you, my friends, are listening to WPR News. We're taking a look at bald eagles and bald eagle watching days that is going to be happening in the Sauk Prairie, in Sauk Prairie area, with our two guests, Jenny Lindenzorf and Jeb Barzin. Great to have both of them with us. Larry in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Larry.
Hi, this is Larry. You will be missed, by the way.
Thank you.
This is tangential to bald eagles. I'm wondering if your guests know anything about the golden eagles that have been roosting for many years during the winter at Devil's Lake State Park, and perhaps they can offer advice to your listeners on how best to go out and look at these birds that are very different in profile from bald eagles, and how these birds go up and soar amongst the bluffs. And I'll get off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling. Jeb, do you want to?
Well, the golden eagles have been using that Devil's Lake State Park area for quite a few years now. So your descriptions are very good. The ecology of golden eagles is different from bald eagles in that they don't gather as much in the wintertime. And these are typically birds that are likely juvenile birds that are dispersing. To our knowledge, they haven't nested yet. And there's been several people who have put considerable effort into seeing if they would start nesting in Devil's Lake. But so far, I don't believe that there's a record of them actually nesting. But one of the things that's interesting about golden eagles is they're not as much carrion feeders as our bald eagles, and they are not as much river feeding or water feeding birds as our bald eagles. And what they're doing when they're cruising the lower Wisconsin River or the upper Mississippi Valley, where there's quite a few golden eagles that overwinter there, they're looking for prey on the bluffs. And we think that the prairies on the bluffs are really important habitats for golden eagles because they can more easily access rabbits or things that they're getting when they're searching on those bluff tops. And so they're really kind of they're very similar species, but they have their distinct niches, and you can see that right in this landscape that we live in.
Larry, thank you very much for calling. Mike in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good afternoon. So mine's just a comment. My family, I was very fortunate. My grandfather bought property on Lake Minocqua after he got back from World War II, and we've had it in the family ever since. And we've had lots of eagles nesting on our property. We've been so fortunate. And people always ask me why the eagles pick our property. But over the past 50, 60 years of my life, I've watched all these new homes come in and all the McMansions and the big houses come in, and they cut down all the trees. And so there's few lots left on some of these higher income lakes there we're fortunate we still have our original one season cabin that was built in the beginning of the 1900s and have all the trees there and trees my grandfather planted. And so we have plenty of spots for the eagles to nest right on the water where they like to be. So anybody out there that's purchasing lakefront property, think about the eagles when you're cutting down all your trees.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thank you very much for calling. It's probably a good comment.
It's kind of hard to add to.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to add to that. you're exactly right, Mike. Thank you very much. We've got another Mike in Coon Valley. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Just want to make a comment. I save all my deer carcasses after hunting, and I haul them out to the field behind our house. As a caveat, I do use solid copper bullets, so there's no worry about the lead contamination there. But and I also pick up some roadkill. I started doing that. And we had 30 eagles at one point coming out to our place. And I remember the guy from talking about the golden eagles, and it's been probably a half dozen years, but one year we did have, I think it was two or three golden eagles kind of take over the rib cages that we had out there, and bald eagles just sat to the side and didn't even challenge them.
Oh, interesting. So they will go to, Jeb, they will... You know, they hunt live prey, but they will go maybe to something, a setup like Mike in Coon Valley has.
Oh, absolutely. You know, any time that you make a prediction about what birds will do, that is about the time that you'll get a caller who comes in and basically proves that you're wrong. So there's lots of exceptions in terms of how birds forage and what they forage on, and those exceptions are kind of the fun things in understanding what makes birds tick. And golden eagles will eat carrion, but they tend to eat live prey more. In fact, in Russia, for example, people train golden eagles to hunt small roe deer. And so they're very voracious hunters when they come down. But there's always exceptions that are out there, and it's a great experience to see them. And we'll certainly put a plug in. It is absolutely wonderful that you're using copper ammunition.
Yeah.
It is safer for birds. It is safer for you as a human consuming that meat. And it also is a more effective ammunition, I've found, when I'm hunting. And so the use of non-lead ammunition is really, really important for eagle ecology. And so I compliment you for that. And if any of you are in the Sauk Prairie area, Fairy Bluff Eagle Council actually subsidizes the sale of copper ammunition so that it's a little bit cheaper so people can try it out and see if they're comfortable using this different ballistics of ammunition.
Yeah, that's what I use as well, and happy to be able to do it. I wanted to mention that right in the beginning, we mentioned PFAS and some research, which is, of course, the forever chemical that's made its way into our drinking water around the state. But there's some really interesting research on PFAS and using eagles kind of as a bird in the canary, canary in the coal mine kind of situation, I guess is what the term.
Yeah, it's just a much bigger cage that they have to use for eagles than for canaries. But so the information that was just on NPR this morning, there's surveys that are done on the Great Lakes, but also on the lower Wisconsin River, and where they're sampling blood from eaglets and looking at contamination that they find in the blood. And one of the chemicals that they're finding, both in the Great Lakes area for Superior and Michigan, as well as in the lower Wisconsin, is they're finding PFAS and in these the blood of eaglets. And so they're very quickly coming into contact with that, presumably from fish that are picking it up in the systems that can, what we call bioaccumulate, those sorts of chemicals if they persist in the fatty tissues of those animals. And so it is a problem. We don't know what kind of impact it would have on young eagles. And as far as we know, the eagle population is either growing or at capacity in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So we don't know how serious of a problem it might be, but it's always disconcerting to see that sort of chemical in eaglets, especially if those chemicals are from, say, paper industry. Those are activities that are occurring, 200 miles away from where birds are coming into contact with that PFAS, and that gives you pause in terms of how, to what degree that chemical can move through the environment.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to bald eagle watching days, and Jenny, you want to kind of go back through as to what people, and by the way, this is a free event for the most part.
Absolutely. It is, all the events are free. And we work very hard, and this is all volunteer run, and it is sponsored. More than half of the funds that we have coming in are from local businesses that help sponsor this, so that we can. It's a very large event for the Sauk Prairie community that brings people in. That's not normally a heavy tourist destination in the cold winter, but the eagles are there to help bring folks in for us. And yeah, as you said, everything is free. We do ask people to pick up some tickets at the River Arts Center for the presentations and for the bus tours to sign up for those.
And John, we had an email. John was wondering about just, can I find a place to park? And is there, obviously there's restaurants, but...
There's street parkings. There is a lot at the overlook on Water Street. I encourage folks to go out to the Fairy Bluff Eagle Council website, where we've got maps and the schedule is posted there for everyone, and some more information on our bus tours and things like that. All the information you need.
Yeah, get there at around 9 at the lobby. You can of the River Arts Center. You can get tickets right there.
The River Arts Center is attached to the high school, so there's a very large parking lot that's all around the River Arts Center. And the picking up the tickets is just to make sure that we don't go over capacity in the theater for the River Arts Center and that sort of thing, and not over capacity for the bus tours. So.
I've used that. That parking lot myself. That's kind of the easy place to go for as far as I'm concerned, because there's usually some room there. Well, Bald Eagle Watching Days, January 17th and 18th. The 17th, there's great programs there. Not only will you see eagles, but check out David Stokes and his from 11:30 to 12:30. His Laughing with Animals is not to be missed. Thank you both, Jenny Lanzendorf, Jeb Barzin, our guests today. Big thanks to our group, Brad Kohlberg, Claire Kniper, Joel Padnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Been great fun, but stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.